Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and support for WEAA is provided by Mid-Atlantic Neurosurgical Associates, MANA, a center dedicated to those who suffer from brain, spine, and pain disorders. With three Baltimore locations, MANA's team of pain management physicians and surgeons provide a wide range of treatment options to improve the health and well-being of its patients. For more information online, manapaincenter.com or 410-601-8314. And in the house now is Dr. Lester Spence, who joins us here frequently, monthly. Professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. He had one thing on his mind. I had another. We'll see where we go. So, Lester Spence, how are you?
I'm doing fine, man. Doing fine now. How about that?
That's good. And I'll just say, even though I do want to talk about this piece you wrote about foreclosures and African-American suburban and middle-class communities, what's happening, I think it's a really dangerous in the sense it's hard to talk about, conversation we have to have. Just want to throw this little piece of news out that the unions in Wisconsin, and the unions are not talking about having a general strike in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's the hotness, isn't it?
Can you imagine if that would happen?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. I was just reading this for this next book project I'm writing. I was just reading a piece about something called the kind of biopolitical exception, you know, the way that states and communities kind of exclude citizens by kind of labeling them somehow as non-citizens. And one of the techniques that this community in Argentina was doing to kind of fight that is they actually would clog the highways and the streets, literally, without, you know, so one way we think about boycotts and protests now, right? But a lot of times when we do that, like the protests or marches, we get like permits to do it, right? They actually close the streets off for us, right? Like at the United States Social Forum. You know, so when I hear about the union considering a general strike, what it makes me think about are some real acts of civil disobedience that really, really bring to light these political, the consequences of this political struggle we're fighting.
And I think that the nature of civil disobedience and that kind of struggle is something that's going it's taking over it is seeping throughout the world, in Egypt, Tunisia, all around the world. And what they don't report about it, in the West Bank and in Israel, it's happening. I have this movie, and you'll hear the interview tomorrow on this show with a woman who made this movie called Boudreaux to Berlin, which is about these Palestinians who cross their political lines, Hamas and Fatah.
Oh, wow.
And then the Israeli activists came across the border to work with them to have a non-violent demonstration to stop the wall and save the olive groves.
Oh, wow.
And there's so many non-violent protests going on like that. Yeah. We don't cover them. All we see is Palestinians throwing stones. And
that's it.
We don't see the power of the nonviolence coming from the community up, and that's what's happening. And you know, and if you can imagine if Wisconsin workers actually closed down every factory and all the public sector to say enough is enough.
Enough is enough. Enough is enough.
Enough is enough.
Right? I mean, so when I've been thinking about our conversations and I've been thinking about because we're going to do this through the year and hopefully, you know, longer. And the thing that I really want to drive home is that politics matters. And I don't just say that because I'm a political scientist. I became a political scientist because politics matters. And we have to kind of recreate this public space to reimagine the political. And it's funny because when we're talking about reimagining the political, in some ways, it's not like we shouldn't have to reimagine that far out. But now, even the idea of a general strike is like radical, right? Where, this is 2011, like 50 years ago, maybe 60 years. I mean, this was like a common tactic that was deployed, right? Successfully.
Right.
To fight power. And now we have to pull that out of a trick bag we haven't used in 50 years. I mean, that's really saying something.
It's in your blood. You're a son of Detroit.
to quote Chrysler, this is what we do.
When your daddy's an auto worker, your family are auto workers.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what we do. Politics matters. What's going on in Wisconsin is so incredibly powerful, right? And so incredibly powerful. And people who are union are up on it. But if you're not up on necessarily union politics, I mean, turn on the TV, go on Facebook, whatever you have to do. This is what the future should look like. This is what our politics should look like, not just in the union, But I remember talking on a panel with the mayor and some other individuals about something like about legalizing drugs in Baltimore.
Oh, that panel from that other place.
Yeah, from the other place. My blow.
I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, no, you had to get it in. Somebody's got to do it. I know. If I were in your chair, I'd be talking. Yeah, other place. And what I was suggesting was that, and from what I didn't see the mayor's reaction, but other people told me, what I was suggesting was that, wow, some cities need to start engaging in civil disobedience to get the state and federal governments to do the right thing. Right. And that was really that sounded really radical, but it's not radical for me. It's like, this is what we do. This is how we make political change.
Right. That's the only way it's going to happen. I hope it spills over. And we'll be talking a lot more about that. Maybe we'll have you on to come back just to have that conversation as well. Be part of that.
Yeah, I'm with that.
So tell us about this piece you're writing. This is I said scary because when I read it this afternoon, it's one of those subjects that's difficult to talk about it because it crosses so many very sensitive lines. But throw your thesis on the table.
So I'm a member of Omega Psi Phi, and I'm a member of there's a mailing list that brothers in Detroit have. And one of them sent me an email about an article about another aspect of the foreclosure crisis that people haven't been covering. When the housing market basically dropped, all of a sudden there are a number of people who lost homes, but on the other hand, there were people who are all of a sudden able to buy really homes in really exclusive neighborhoods, right? $300,000 homes that were now $100,000, right? $400,000 homes you can get for $150,000. So all of a sudden, you've got people in these neighborhoods who bought $400,000 homes, and then all of a sudden, people who, in the Detroit case, people were kind of working class and poor, either renting these homes, buying these homes, or squatting these homes. And you've got this real culture clash because you've got people on the one hand who maybe barbecue in the front yard, who maybe play certain types of music all hours of night, you know, with kids who walk up and down the middle of the street as opposed to the sidewalks. And then you've got these older, quote unquote, middle class people who believe that their grass should be cut on time, who want, quote unquote, peace and security, and they're not really able to work that out. Right.
It's like you're talking about African American community.
I'm talking about black people.
Right.
Right. I'm not talking about whites and blacks or blacks and Latinos. I'm talking about all black people. So I've got a blog, lesterspence.com/blog, if you're interested. And I just wrote a couple of paragraphs about this just as a way to get people to think about the politics that are at play here. Because usually when we talk about race and politics, what we're talking about is black people on one hand or white people on the other, or black people on the one hand and Jews on the other. And what that ignores is the degree to which gender, class, and sexuality are really, really contentious issues within black communities, right? So in this specific instance, you could easily come up with a quote-unquote black community narrative that would say, wow, black people should be able to be free to buy houses wherever they want, right? At the same time, you can come up with a quote-unquote black community narrative that says, wow, black people should be safe and secure in their own homes and should be able to, you know, go to sleep without hearing music blaring at night. You've got two very different black community interests at play here. You know, how do you figure them out? You can't rely on blackness because everybody's black. And I think that we're going to see these issues. We've already seen these issues playing themselves out rhetorically. You know, so when Bill Cosby says that the lower income people aren't holding up their end of the bargain in 2005, mm-hmm. when Barack Obama says, okay, all these ills that are facing the black community is basically because we've got these wayward black fathers. Now we're actually starting to see these dynamics play themselves out at a neighborhood level. And you're right. It has the potential to be really dangerous.
So, folks, think about what Lester Spencer just posited out here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Think about your own communities and within the black community itself, the issue of class, the issue of culture, the issue of how one lives, and it's a subject that most people do not want to tackle. But let's tackle it a bit together. 410-319-8888. I think that Lester, you know what you're saying. A lot of middle class communities face that. I remember living for 25 years in Windsor Hills, on the west side of this town, mostly African-American neighborhood, mixed, but mostly African-American. And folks who moved into the neighborhood who were from the inner city, who found a house to rent, a cheap house to buy, and everybody said, welcome, glad you're here. But those issues existed in terms of music loud, kids out until 3 or 4 in the morning, people telling them, please turn the music down. People, you know, this is, and it's a culture clash.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So how do you deal with that issue? I mean, how do you begin to think about resolving all that?
I'm kind of low maintenance, and you know what I mean? I am a Johns Hopkins professor, and even though I'm broke, then one level that materially places me in a different class, mm-hmm. right? But still, because I grew up in a working class neighborhood, I kind of know how they roll. So, you know, and that's part of me too. It's not just they, because I still embrace that. So the way I deal with it on the individual level is, like, I just give people a wide latitude to be who they are. But the real question is, how do you deal with that on a community level, given these crises we're dealing with, you know, given these larger crises? These larger crises we're dealing with, like this Wisconsin stuff, is indirectly related to this stuff. We can't imagine solidarity, right, if we can't engage in solidarity on our own block. Right. Mm-hmm. If you got somebody across the street from you, in my parents' house, there's a good kid who lived across the street. He lost the house for a second, but I think he got it back. And every July 4th, he'd have this big July 4th fireworks thing in front of the yard. So at the end, he'd have all these scraps of firework paper that mom would be like, oh, my God, I wish X would pick that stuff up. I can't believe this. I mean, if you can't, you know, if that type of tension really makes it hard to organize politically, because on some level, what you're doing is you're placing them. I talked about biopolitics earlier. What you're in effect doing with that language is you're placing them. You're placing these people outside of the community of care that's required for political solidarity.
We have some folks calling and let us get some thoughts. Dr. Lester Spence is in the house. You can check him out at what is it again, Lester? This blog we're talking about is at
lesterspence.com. It'll take you to my website, and then, like, I have a blog section up there.
Or you can go to Facebook to Lester K. Spence.
Lester K. Spence, and then, I'm a public, so I've got a fan page, right. Lester K. Spence, and then I'm on Twitter at Lester Spence.
I tried to do that, man. It would let me, you know, become a fan.
I only got like 5. I don't see why.
You might have more than 5, man. You got like.
I got 61.
I was going to be 61. You had like 60.
Yeah. So you'd have been 61.
I'll get on there. I'll see what's going on. 410-319-8888. Cindy in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Spence.
Hi, Cindy. Welcome.
Hi. I was listening to the show, and I totally agree with the comments that Mr. Spence said about the foreclosure and how it has really affected neighborhoods that have been previously stabilized. I live in a neighborhood that was previously primarily Jewish, and I moved into the neighborhood probably 15, 16 years ago. And because of the foreclosure market, a lot of the houses have now turned into rentals, and the neighborhood began to change a little bit. And we have a tight-knit neighborhood, and it's very diverse with Jewish and Asian and Russian. But it just seems like the home ownership that was once in the neighborhood has changed a lot into the rental. And so we don't see the same kind of care taken in the houses that are rental versus the houses that are home ownership. And we try to, you know, have the same kind of solidarity that you were talking about and bringing everybody into the neighborhood, but there's a different kind of atmosphere in the neighborhood. And I just wanted to see if you could address that a little bit.
First of all, thanks for calling. Second, I actually live in Pikesville, so I might drive by your house like on the way home. And you're right. I mean, so without putting my stuff all the way out there, it's like one of the things when we bought out there in Pikesville, it was actually hard for us to maintain the home because everybody else is cutting their grass, for example, like they're not even cutting their grass. They've got a lawn guy who cuts their grass. And like we got a family of seven and like money is tight. So it's like me cutting the grass and my boys cutting the grass. So I can't cut the grass all the time, right? So is that, and then what she's talking about is a different class of person, right, where they actually are renters rather than homeowners. And that creates a different political neighborhood with a different political relationship with the neighborhood, right? In that homeowners are invested in their community because their property values are at stake, whereas renters may be invested, but they're invested in a very different way. I would suggest, like, one of the the only way to really deal with that is to kind of deal with it straight on by really thinking critically about what a community would look like if home ownership weren't on the table, right? So you can't do anything with the fact that you're homeowners and they're not. That's going to create a gap that you can't ever really overcome. But on that relationship, what you have to do is create another relationship, another set of relationships, another type of public space where that's not the central thing.
It's crossing boundaries in your own neighborhood. It's being willing to do that. I mean,
yeah.
Bringing people into the circle of the community when things happen in the neighborhood, making people part of something, makes it much easier then to go, hey, look, you know,
cut your grass.
Yeah, you know, or whatever right?
Yeah,
I know we all like to have fun, but you know, you need to just cut the noise down a little bit at this time so you can we all can sleep and go to bed. But the other part is that you support folks who are renting and force their landlords to keep up their houses.
Oh, wow. See,
you know, you cross the street the other way.
See, Mark's a real leftist. that's it, right?
Or you think about folks who come from deep inner city neighborhoods to a neighborhood like in Pikesville, let's say, or Randallstown or wherever that is,
mm-hmm.
Wherever that Towson, whatever it might be. Probably this might sound silly, but probably never pushed a lawnmower in their lives.
Wow! Yeah.
Own a lawnmower.
Yeah. Yeah.
An edger.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's
no, that's real, yeah.
And all that is part of the equation. I mean, it's also that you can't live in Baltimore City, or in the metropolitan area, and not live a stone's throw away from poverty. If you're not poor yourself,
yeah, that's right.
You know what I'm saying,
yeah,
you're a struggling working class, middle class family. You're going to live right next to poverty in this community because that's how close we all are.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a two-tier process, or not quite two-stage. It's like they occur in parallel. It's like on one hand, it's like you're trying to kind of reaching people where they are and just making, you know, their neighbors. They are still your neighbors, right? It's about just being neighborly. But on the other hand, it's about thinking about different ways to think about your political community in ways that can aid them
exactly.
And then aid yourself.
We have a lot of people calling in. We started something. You started something. 410-319-8888. I'm Mark Steiner here with Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, for his monthly visit. It feels like more than monthly. But anyway, Charles, you're on the air.
Yes, I was listening. I caught the comments you were making, particularly about Detroit and the situation with economics in terms of a neighborhood that looks ethnically the same. And I've always found that interesting. As we talk about being African Americans in particular, there is a myth that we are always given that we were always a unified people. We always live a certain way.
Yes.
And I know for a fact, for example, in Baltimore City, in Zone 7, and along a certain corridor, that certain families lived on certain streets. Certain families, mm-hmm. and those families lived on other streets.
Mm-hmm.
But the media, as well as we as African Americans, continue to perpetuate that myth.
Yeah.
That we all have the same things in common, and we don't.
Yep.
With our brethren who don't necessarily, who aren't necessarily where we are. And I was, as I said, I just found that particularly interesting. And having grown up in North Carolina in a much more integrated environment than Baltimore City all these years,
oh, wow.
What I really find interesting about that is the same issues that we talk about, they're also very prevalent with our counterpart, European or white counterpart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But no one really addresses them the same way. There's not the the monolith,
yeah,
of whiteness or the monolith of blackness,
yeah,
that exists either.
Yeah, that's right. That's an excellent point.
Lester.
So you can find there are three really good books on black Detroit history. There are a couple that deal with the 20th century. But there's one, I think it's called Before the Ghetto, Building Black Community in Detroit. And it deals with black Detroit like in from the 1860s maybe onward. As early as like 1860, 1870, you can see a black middle class and black upper class basically blaming racism on two populations, working class whites and poor black people from the South. As early as the 19th century. And you see that replicated everywhere there are enough black people to have political differences or have class differences. And that's and there are a number of understandable reasons why we kind of put that under the table and don't really talk about it. But those reasons aren't they weren't viable then and they weren't viable now. What they lead to is a group of black people who create this monolithic black interest that really is a specific class interest as opposed to like black interest broadly considered.
I appreciate those thoughts. This is an interesting dialogue. 410-319-8888 and an important one. Let's talk about your neighborhood and your thoughts about the issues that Lester Spence is positing here about the class nature of our world, about foreclosures, how they change the nature of a community. How folks of different classes within the community can actually live side by side. And Gladys, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi,
Gladys.
This is a very interesting show. I was calling to comment on the previous caller, and I too was wanting to know the same, had the same concern about renters versus homeowners, because I live in a neighborhood where I'm a homeowner. When I first moved there, it was all homeowners, and it was a mixed race of class of people, hardworking people. And then as the years went by, because I've been there over 16 years, when people would move, the replacement would be renters. And, of course, their concern wasn't the same concern that you had as a homeowner. And I just felt like I was listening to what Mr. Spencer said, but I can't expect them to be like I am as a homeowner. But I just thought that, you know, their landlords could be contacted with the concern to let them know, as you know, a group of people or a group of concerned neighbors in the neighborhood, that, you know, we still want to maintain a decent neighborhood, and that I think is that I felt as though it was their responsibility to make sure that the grounds be kept up, or they rent to, you know, people that were very responsible. Look, I grew up in a very well-noted neighborhood in Northwest Baltimore, in the Ashburton area, and then all beautiful homeowners growing up back in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. And we always rented, but we did not want to be set aside to know, you know, set out as an eyesore. So my grandmother who raised me, she made sure that she kept up that property that she was renting so that we wouldn't be the talk of the neighborhood. And I just felt right. That, you know, why can't the landlords be contacted when there's an issue?
You raised some.
That's basically my comment.
No, you raised some thoughts on that are multi-level of thoughts here, I think, Lester.
Both
in terms of the pride of upkeep and also mm-hmm. the responsibility of landlords and living with the community together.
Yeah, and actually, so I actually, when I first moved here, we rented in Ashburton our first 2 years. I mean, absolutely beautiful neighborhood. Best neighborhood that I've ever lived in. Best neighborhood. So I understand those tensions from the middle class from the perspective of someone who was like who wants to upkeep their property. My parents are like that. My in-laws are like that. My wife is like that. I'm like that to a certain degree. But that logic taken to its extreme, what it leads to is basically subjugating a class of people because they're not like us, right? They don't cut the grass like we do. They don't listen to the same music we do. All I want is peace and quiet. And then it just drives them further away. And it leads to really negative politics, and everybody loses. So I really understand your frustration, and I don't have all the answers. Hell, I mean, in the blog post, it was just more like about bringing up questions. But what I do know is that what we have to do is find a way to bridge these differences along. We have to find a way to bridge these differences, because even though we differ along home ownership lines, we're in the same general class position, right? So we're all facing the same type of economic anxiety. Maybe they're not dealing with the likelihood of their home being foreclosed on because they're renting, but they may be dealing with other economic challenges.
And I think in a weird way here, this is made me think of this thing that then Stanley, we're going to come right to your call from Randallstown, is that nobody wants to go back to segregation. But in the period of segregation, when black folks in the South especially, and in the North too, were forced to live in the same communities, no matter what, whether you were a doctor, an undertaker, a laborer, or carpenter, whatever your job may be, there were culture itself was more united, even though there were differences. Culture itself was more united on some levels because of the nature of oppression, I'll posit. And B, there were still attitudes within the community. Like my friend Deirdre, this is an example because it made me think of it as soon as you were talking. I can hear her talking, her mother talking. They live in Harlem in what was Sugar Hill, which is where jazz artists lived and most of the middle class, but all around lots of poor folks and working folks as well. And her mother would always rail about low classical people.
What?
Which was the way she would put it, which is low classical.
I'm going to use that one.
Low
classical.
But so that was always there on lots of levels, you know?
Yeah. I mean, people find ways to create borders. So even if you got enough black people in a segregated area to have like a large neighborhood, I'm willing to bet that in most cases you had an imaginary border that was real. Like you don't cross that side of the street. The wrong people live on that side of the street, right? I mean, in a place like in urban areas, you know, up north you find it, you know, so St. Louis is north-south, Detroit is east-west, Baltimore, I guess, is kind of east.
It was for a long time. East west was a big dividing line.
Yeah,
some people say not anymore. I think less so. But
if you're from Baltimore, it still means something.
Yeah, well, east side, west side.
Yeah.
You know, it's country, back in the day, it was more like country versus urban.
You're right.
That
right.
Was 410-319-8888. Stanley in Randallstown. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Steiner. How are you?
I'm well, Stanley. Welcome.
Thank you. I truly enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just have to just have a little spin on what's been talked about tonight. I've heard, you know, mention of like culture clashes in certain neighborhoods. But what about the ones who move into the neighborhoods and try to assimilate, so to speak, and feel the pressure of, I guess, not being accepted or maybe not living up to the standards, regardless of what they do to try to fit in. And let me give a quick example. My wife and I purchased a home in Randallstown about 8 years ago. We're considered middle class. We're both professionals, two kids, you know, the I guess the classic dream, you know. And, you know, we keep our lawn cut and, you know, keep the house looking nice. But, you know, it seems like, you know, sometimes when I talk to my neighbors, and I live in a 40% Jewish neighborhood, you know, sometimes I get, you know, comments like, oh, that, you know, that bush could be cut, or, you know, and, you know,
yeah.
I'm just like, oh, yeah. Okay, you know, and actually one time I told one of my neighbors, well, do you have $500 for me to trim my tree? You know,
yeah.
It's like,
right.
You know, what do we have to do to prove that we're upstanding citizens, you know, in certain neighborhoods. I mean, you know, it's sometimes it just the pressure is unfair. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
And that's real.
That's very real.
That's real talk
for all of us. That's happened. Not to me too.
Yeah, I mean that happens with the house we got. And it's like, you know, I have to look. I'm like, oh, man, they cut the grass. I got to cut the grass there. I got to get one of the boys cut the grass. Like, man, it's cumulative, right? So you're supposed to theoretically go home and be safe, right? As soon as you walk in the house, theoretically, it should be like, whew, I'm home. That's what home ownership or even renting, that's what it's supposed to be like. But it's not like that. And it's getting worse.
Well, see, now, first of all, we're just about cutting the grass. So don't have a lawn.
Yeah, you know, so I was thinking about. So the radical thing, right, is you take your lawn. So I don't. You have to have had this guy on your show, the guy who's actually making like yards like into community gardens.
Yes,
it's kind of like the protest thing. Like, yeah, that's not. That's.
I mean, one of the houses I had a small cornfield in my front lawn. I used to.
Yeah.
Some neighbors didn't like it, some did, but I shared the corn.
Yeah. They liked it when they got that free corn.
But I hate cutting grass.
I hate it.
It is the biggest waste of time on the planet Earth.
I hate it.
Anyway, that's a weird note to end this conversation, what we just did. Thank you all for calling in and making the show what it is. And Dr. Lester Spence, thank you for gracing our studios once again.
Oh, it's over already?
You'll be back.
Oh, man.
You coming back?
Man.
Thank you, Lester. It's great to have you. Professor of Political Science, Morgan State University, will be on soon with his new book as well. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out about our guests and their work, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And very quick, Lester, what?
Give a shout out to Megan and Katarina, a couple of students I met that they wanted me to give a shout out to.
You got it. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.